Side 3.
Oddly, the man's face was now only a couple of feet away. He seemed in one way to be a perfectly normal shape, but his body was sitting cross-legged on a pole 40 feet away, while his face was only 2 feet from Arthur's. Without moving his head, and without seeming to do anything odd at all, he stood up and stepped onto the top of another pole. Either it was just the heat, thought Arthur, or space was a different shape for him. "A beach house," he said, "doesn't even have to be on the beach. They're the best ones are. We all like to congregate," he said, "at boundary conditions." "Really?" said Arthur. "Where land meets water, where earth meets air, where body meets mind, where space meets time. We like to be on one side and look at the other." Arthur got terribly excited. This was exactly the sort of thing he'd been promised in the brochure. He was a man who seemed to be moving through some kind of Escher space, saying really profound things about all sorts of stuff. It was unnerving, though. The man was now stepping from pole to ground, from ground to pole, from pole to pole, from pole to horizon and back. He was making complete nonsense of Arthur's spatial universe. "Please stop," Arthur said suddenly.
"Can't take it, huh?" said the man.
Without the slightest movement, he was now back, sitting cross-legged on top of the pole 40 feet in front of Arthur.
"You come to me for advice, but you can't cope with anything you don't recognize. So we'll have to tell you something you already know, but make it sound like news, eh? Well, business as usual, I suppose."
He sighed and squinted mournfully into the distance.
"Where are you from, boy?" he then said.
Arthur decided to be clever. He was fed up with being mistaken for a complete idiot by everyone he ever met.
"Tell you what," he said. "You're a seer. Why don't you tell me?"
The old man sighed again. "I was just," he said, passing his hand round behind his head, "making conversation." When he brought his hand round to the front again, he had a globe of the earth spinning on his up-pointed forefinger. It was unmistakable. He put it away again. Arthur was stunned.
"How did you—"
"I can't tell you."
"Why not? I've come all this way."
"You cannot see what I see because you see what you see. You cannot know what I know because you know what you know. What I see and what I know cannot be added to what you see and what you know, because they are not of the same kind. Neither can it replace what you see and what you know, because that would be to replace you yourself."
"Hang on, can I write this down?" said Arthur, excitedly fumbling in his pocket for a pencil.
"You can pick up a copy at the spaceport," said the old man. "They've got racks of the stuff."
"Oh," said Arthur, disappointed. "Well, isn't there anything that's perhaps a bit more specific to me?"
"Everything you see or hear or experience in any way at all is specific to you. You create a universe by perceiving it, so everything in the universe you perceive is specific to you."
Arthur looked at him doubtfully.
"Can I get that at the spaceport too?" he said.
"Check it out," said the old man.
It says in the brochure," said Arthur, pulling it out of his pocket and looking at it again, "that I can have a special prayer individually tailored to me and my special needs."
"Oh, all right," said the old man. "Here's a prayer for you. Got a pencil?"
"Yes," said Arthur.
"It goes like this. Let me see now. Protect me from knowing what I don't need to know. Protect me from even knowing that there are things to know that I don't know. Protect me from knowing that I decided not to know about the things that I decided not to know about. Amen." That's it. It's what you pray silently inside yourself anyway, so you may as well have it out in the open.
Said Arthur. Thank you.
There's another prayer that goes with it that's very important," continued the old man, "so you'd better jot this down, too."
Okay.
It goes, "Lord, Lord, Lord." It's best to put that bit in just in case. You can never be too sure. "Lord, Lord, Lord, protect me from the consequences of the above prayer. Amen." And that's it. Most of the trouble people get into in life comes from missing out that last part.
"Ever heard of a place called Stavromula Beta?" asked Arthur.
"No."
"Well, thank you for your help," said Arthur.
"Don't mention it," said the man on the pole, and vanished.
Chapter 10. Ford Prefect hurled himself at the door of the editor-in-chief's office, tucked himself into a tight ball as the frame splintered and gave away once again, rolled rapidly across the floor to where the smart grey crushed leather sofa was, and set up his strategic operational base behind it. That, at least, was the plan. Unfortunately, the smart grey crushed leather sofa wasn't there.
Why? Thought Ford as he twisted himself around in midair, lurched, dived, and scuttled for cover behind Hal's desk. Do people have this stupid obsession with rearranging their office furniture every 5 minutes? Why, for instance, replace a perfectly serviceable, if rather muted, grey crushed leather sofa with what appeared to be a small tank? And who is the big guy with a mobile rocket launcher on his shoulder? Someone from head office? Couldn't be. This was head office. At least it was the head office of the Guide, where these Infinitim Enterprises guys came from, Zarquan knew. Nowhere very sunny, judging from the slug-like colour and texture of their skins. This is all wrong, thought Ford. People connected with the Guide should come from sunny places. There were several of them, in fact, and all of them seemed to be more heavily armed and armoured than you would normally expect corporate executives to be, even in today's rough-and-tumble business world. He was making a lot of assumptions here, of course. He was assuming that the big, bull-necked, slug-like guys were in some way connected with Infinitim Enterprises. But it was a reasonable assumption, and he felt happy about it, because they had logos on their armour plating which said Infinitim Enterprises on them. He had a nagging suspicion that this was not a business meeting, though. He also had a nagging feeling that these slug-like creatures were familiar to him in some way. Familiar, but in an unfamiliar guise. Well, he had been in the room for a good 2.5 seconds now, and thought it was probably time to start doing something constructive. He could take a hostage. That would be good. Van Hal was in his swivel chair, looking alarmed, pale, and shaken. He probably had some bad news, as well as a nasty bang to the back of his head. Ford leapt to his feet and made a running grab for him. Under the pretext of getting him into a good, solid, double-underpinned elbow lock, Ford managed surreptitiously to slip the Identi-Ease back into Hal's inner pocket. Bingo. He'd done what he came to do. Now he just had to talk his way out of here. Okay, he said, He paused. The big guy with the rocket launcher was turning towards Ford Prefect and pointing it at him, which Ford couldn't help feeling was wildly irresponsible behaviour. He started again, and then, on a sudden impulse, decided to duck. There was a deafening roar as flames leapt from the back of the rocket launcher, and a rocket leapt from its front. The rocket hurtled past Ford and hit the large plate-glass window, which billowed outwards in a shower of a million shards under the force of the explosion. Huge shockwaves of noise and air pressure reverberated around the room, sweeping a couple of chairs, a filing cabinet, and Colin the security robot out of the window. Ah, so they're not totally rocket-proof after all, thought Ford Prefect to himself. Someone should have a word with somebody about that. He disentangled himself from Hal and tried to work out which way to run. He was surrounded. The big guy with the rocket launcher was moving it up into position again for another shot. Ford was completely at a loss for what to do next. Look, he said in a stern voice, but he wasn't certain how far saying things like look in a stern voice was necessarily going to get him, and time was not on his side. What the hell, he thought, you're only young once, and threw himself out of the window. That would at least keep the element of surprise on his side. Chapter 11. The first thing Arthur Dent had to do, he realised resignedly, was to get himself a life. This meant he had to find a planet he could have one on. It had to be a planet he could breathe on, where he could stand up and sit down without experiencing gravitational discomfort. It had to be somewhere where the acid levels were low and the plants didn't actually attack you. I hate to be anthropic about this, he said to the strange thing behind the desk at the Resettlement Advice Centre on Pintleton Alpha, but I quite like to live somewhere where the people sort of look vaguely like me as well. You know, sort of human. The strange thing behind the desk waved some of its stranger bits around and seemed rather taken aback by this. It oozed and glopped off its seat, thrashed its way slowly across the floor, ingested the old metal filing cabinet, and then, with a great belch, excreted the appropriate drawer. It popped out a couple of glistening tentacles from its ear, removed some files from the drawer, sucked the drawer back in, and vomited up the cabinet again. It thrashed its way back across the floor, slimed its way back up onto the seat, and slapped the files on the table. "See anything you fancy?" it asked. Arthur looked nervously through the grubby and damp pieces of paper. He was definitely in some backwater part of the galaxy here, and somewhere off to the left as far as the universe he knew and recognised was concerned. In the space where his own home should have been, there was a rotten hick planet, drowned with rain and inhabited by thugs and boghogs. Even the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy seemed to work only fitfully here, which is why he was reduced to making these sorts of inquiries in these sorts of places. One place he always asked after was Stavromula Beta, but no one had ever heard of such a planet. The available worlds looked pretty grim. They had little to offer him because he had little to offer them. He had been extremely chastened to realise that although he originally came from a world which had cars and computers and ballet and Armagnac, he didn't by himself know how any of it worked. He couldn't do it. Left to his own devices, he couldn't build a toaster. He could just about make a sandwich, and that was it. There was not a lot of demand for his services. Arthur's heart sank. This surprised him, because he thought it was already about as low as it could possibly be. He closed his eyes for a moment. He so much wanted to be home. He so much wanted his own home world, the actual earth he had grown up on, not to have been demolished. He so much wanted none of this to have happened. He so much wanted that when he opened his eyes again, he would be standing on the doorstep of his little cottage in the West Country of England, that the sun would be shining over the green hills, the post van would be going up the lane, the daffodils would be blooming in his garden, and in the distance the pub would be opening for lunch. He so much wanted to take the newspaper down to the pub and read it over a pint of bitter. He so much wanted to do the crossword. He so much wanted to be able to get completely stuck on 17 across. He opened his eyes. The strange thing was pulsating irritably at him, tapping some kind of pseudopodium on the desk. Arthur shook his head and looked at the next sheet of paper. Grim, he thought. And the next. Very grim. And the next. Oh, now that looked better. It was a world called Bartledan. It had oxygen. It had green hills. It even, it seemed, had a renowned literary culture. But the thing that most aroused his interest was a photograph of a small bunch of Bartledanian people standing around in a village square, smiling pleasantly at the camera. Ah, he said, and held the picture up to the strange thing behind the desk. Its eyes squirmed out on stalks and rolled up and down the piece of paper, leaving a glistening trail of slime all over it. Yes, it said, with distaste, I do look exactly like you. Arthur moved to Bartledan, and using some money he had made by selling some toenail clippings and spit to a DNA bank, he bought himself a room in the village featured in the picture. It was pleasant there. The air was balmy. The people looked like him and seemed not to mind him being there. They didn't attack him with anything. He bought some clothes and a cupboard to put them in. He had got himself a life. Now he had to find a purpose in it. At first he tried to sit and read. But the literature of Bartledan, famed though it was throughout this sector of the galaxy for its subtlety and grace, didn't seem to be able to sustain his interest. The problem was that it wasn't actually about human beings after all. It wasn't about what human beings wanted. The people of Bartledan were remarkably like human beings to look at, but when you said good evening to one, he would tend to look around with a slight sense of surprise, sniff the air and say that, yes, he supposed that it probably was a goodish evening now that Arthur came to mention it. No, what I meant was to wish you a good evening, Arthur would say, or rather used to say. He soon learned to avoid these conversations. I mean that I hope you have a good evening, he would add. More puzzlement. Wish? The Bartledanian would say at last in polite bafflement. Yes, Arthur would then have said. I'm just expressing the hope that... Hope? Yes, said Arthur. What is hope? The Bartledanian would say. On the one hand, he could only recognise and respect what he learnt about the Bartledanian view of the universe, which was that the universe was what the universe was, take it or leave it. On the other hand, he could not help but feel that not to desire anything, not ever to wish or to hope, was just not natural. Natural, there was a tricky word. He had long ago realised that a lot of things that he had thought of as natural, like buying people presents at Christmas, stopping at red lights, or falling at a rate of 32 feet per second per second, were just the habits of his own world and didn't necessarily work the same way anywhere else. But not to wish, that really couldn't be natural, could it? That would be like not breathing. Breathing was another thing the Bartledanians didn't do, despite all the oxygen in the atmosphere. They just stood there. Occasionally they ran around and played netball and stuff, without ever wishing to win, though, of course. They would just play, and whoever won, won. But they never actually breathed. It was, for some reason, unnecessary. Arthur quickly learned that playing netball with them was just too spooky. Though they looked like humans, and even moved and sounded like humans, they didn't breathe, and they didn't wish for things. Breathing and wishing for things, on the other hand, was just about all that Arthur seemed to do all day. Sometimes he'd wish for things so much that his breathing would get quite agitated and he would need to go and have a lie down for a bit. On his own, in his small room, so far from the world which had given birth to him, that his brain could not even process the sort of numbers involved without just going limp. He preferred not to think about it. He preferred just to sit and read, or at least he would prefer it if there was anything worth reading. But nobody in Bartledanian's stories ever wanted anything, not even a glass of water. Certainly they would fetch one if they were thirsty, but if there wasn't one available, they would think no more about it. He had just read an entire book in which the main character had, over the course of a week, done some work in his garden, played a great deal of netball, helped mend a road, fathered a child on his wife, and then unexpectedly died of thirst just before the last chapter. In exasperation, Arthur had combed his way back through the book, and in the end had found a passing reference to some problem with the plumbing in chapter 2. And that was it. So the guy dies. It just happens. It wasn't even the climax of the book, because there wasn't one. The character died about a third of the way through the penultimate chapter of the book, and the rest of it was just more stuff about road mending. The book just finished dead at the 100,000th word, because that was how long books were on Bartledan. Arthur threw the book across the room, sold the room, and left. He started to travel with wild abandon, trading in more and more spit, toenails, fingernails, blood, hair, anything that anybody wanted, for tickets. For seamen, he discovered he could travel first class. He settled nowhere, but only existed in the hermetic twilight world of the cabins of hyperspatial starships, eating, drinking, sleeping, watching movies, only stopping at spaceports to donate more DNA and catch the next long-haul ship out. He waited and waited for another accident to happen. The trouble with trying to make the right accident happen is that it won't. That is not what accident means. The accident that eventually occurred was not what he had planned at all. The ship he was on blipped in hyperspace, flickered horribly between 97 different points in the galaxy simultaneously, caught the unexpected gravitational pull of an uncharted planet in one of them, became ensnared in its outer atmosphere, and began to fall, screaming and tearing into it. The ship's systems protested all the way down that everything was perfectly normal and under control. But when it went into a final hectic spin, ripped wildly through half a mile of trees, and finally exploded into a seething ball of flame, it became clear that this was not the case. Fire engulfed the forest, boiled into the night, then neatly put itself out, as all unscheduled fires over a certain size are now required to do by law. For a short while afterwards, other small fires flared up here and there as odd pieces of scattered debris exploded quietly in their own time. Then they, too, died away. Arthur Dent, who because of the sheer boredom of endless interstellar flight was the only one on board who actually had familiarized himself with the ship's safety procedures in case of an unscheduled landing, was the sole survivor. He lay dazed, broken, and bleeding, in a sort of fluffy pink plastic cocoon with "Have a nice day" printed in over 3,000 different languages all over it. Black, roaring silences swam sickeningly through his shattered mind. He knew with a kind of resigned certainty that he would survive because he had not yet been to Stavromula Beta. After what seemed an eternity of pain and darkness, he became aware of quiet shapes moving around him. Chapter 12. Ford tumbled through the open air in a cloud of glass splinters and chair parts. Again, he hadn't really thought things through, really, and was just playing it by ear, buying time. At times of major crisis, he found it was often quite helpful to have his life flash before his eyes. Gave him a chance to reflect on things, see things in some sort of perspective, and it sometimes furnished him with a vital clue as to what to do next. There was the ground rushing up to meet him at 30 feet per second, but he would, he thought, deal with that problem when he got to it. First things first. Ah, here it came. His childhood. Humdrum stuff, he'd been through it all before. Images flashed by, boring times on Beetlejuice 5, Zaphod Beeblebrox as a kid. Yes, he knew all that. He wished he had some kind of fast-forward in his brain. His 7th birthday party, being given his first towel. Come on, come on. He was twisting and turning downwards, the outside air at this height a cold shock to his lungs, trying not to inhale glass. Early voyages to other planets. Oh, for Zark's sake, this is like some sort of bloody travelogue documentary before the main feature. First beginning to work for the guide. Ah, those were the days. They worked out of a hut on the Buonelli Atoll on Fanella before the Rictonarchals and the Dankweds fertled it. Half a dozen guys, some towels, a handful of highly sophisticated digital devices, and most importantly, a lot of dreams. No, most importantly, a lot of Fanellan rum.
To be completely accurate, that old jank spirit was the absolute most important thing, then the Fenalan rum, and also some of the beaches on the atoll where the local girls would hang out, but dreams were important as well. Whatever happened to those? He couldn't quite remember what the dreams were, in fact, but they had seemed immensely important at the time. That certainly not involved this huge towering office block he was now falling down the side of. All of that had come when some of the original team had started to settle down and get greedy, while he and others had stayed out in the field, researching and hitchhiking and gradually becoming more and more isolated from the corporate nightmare the guide had inexorably turned into, and the architectural monstrosity it had come to occupy. Where were the dreams in that? He thought of all the corporate lawyers who occupied half of the building, all the operatives who occupied the lower levels, and all the sub-editors and their secretaries and their secretaries' lawyers and their secretaries' lawyer secretaries, and worst of all, the accountants and the marketing department. He had half a mind just to keep on falling, a finger to the lot of them. He was just passing the 17th floor now, where the marketing department hung out. Load of tosspots all arguing about what colour the guide should be, and exercising their infinitely infallible skills of being wise after the event. If any of them had chosen to look out of the window at that moment, they would have been startled by the sight of Ford Prefect dropping past them to a certain death and flicking the finger at them. 16th floor, sub-editors, bastards. What about all that copy of his they'd cut? 15 years of research he'd filed from one planet alone, and they'd cut it to two words, mostly harmless. A finger to them as well. 15th floor. Logistical administration, whatever that was about. They all had big cars. That, he thought, was what that was about. 14th floor. Personnel. He had a very shrewd suspicion that it was they who had engineered his 15-year exile while the guide metamorphosed into the corporate monolith, or rather duolith, mustn't forget the lawyers, it had become. He was having to think rather fast at the moment because the situation was becoming a little urgent. He suddenly remembered the floor display panel in the elevator. It hadn't had a 13th floor. He thought no more about it because, having spent 15 years on the rather backward planet Earth, where they were superstitious about the number 13, he was used to being in buildings that numbered their floors without it. No reason for that here, though. The windows of the 13th floor, he could not help noticing as he flashed swiftly by them, were darkened. What was going on in there? He started to remember all the stuff that Harl had been talking about. One new multidimensional guide spread across an infinite number of universes. It had sounded, the way Harl had put it, like wild meaninglessness dreamed up by the marketing department with the backing of the accountants. If it was any more real than that, then it was a very weird and dangerous idea. Was it real? What was going on behind the darkened windows of the sealed-off 13th floor? Ford felt a rising sense of curiosity, and then a rising sense of panic. That was the complete list of rising feelings he had. In every other respect, he was falling very rapidly. He really ought to turn his mind to wondering how he's going to get out of the situation alive. He glanced down. 100 feet or so below him, people were milling around, some of them beginning to look up expectantly, clearing a space for him, even temporarily calling off the wonderful and completely fatuous hunt for Wockets. He would hate to disappoint them, but about 2 feet below him, he hadn't realised before, was Colin. Colin had obviously been happily dancing attendance and waiting for him to decide what he wanted to do. Colin! Ford bawled. Colin didn't respond. Ford went cold. Then he suddenly realised that he hadn't told Colin his name was Colin. Come up here! Ford bawled. Colin bobbed up beside him. Colin was enjoying the ride down immensely and hoped that Ford was too. Colin's world went unexpectedly dark as Ford's towel suddenly enveloped him. Colin immediately felt himself get much, much heavier. He was thrilled and delighted by the challenge that Ford had presented him with. Just not sure he could handle it, that was all. The towel was slung over Colin. Ford was hanging from the towel, gripping to its seams. Other hitchhikers had seen fit to modify their towels in exotic ways, weaving all kinds of esoteric tools and utilities and even computer equipment into their fabric. Ford was a purist. He liked to keep things simple. He carried a regular towel from a regular domestic soft furnishings shop. It even had a kind of blue and pink floral pattern, despite his repeated attempts to bleach and stonewash it. It had a couple of pieces of wire threaded into it, a bit of flexible writing stick, and also some nutrients soaked into one of the corners of the fabric, so he could suck it in an emergency, but otherwise it was a simple towel you could dry your face on. The only actual modification he had been persuaded by a friend to make to it was to reinforce the seams. Ford gripped the seams like a maniac. They were still descending, but the rate had slowed. Up, Colin! He shouted. Nothing.
Your name, shouted Ford, is Colin. So when I shout up, Colin, I want you, Colin, to go up. Okay? Up, Colin. Nothing. Or rather a sort of muffled groaning sound from Colin. Ford was very anxious. They were descending very slowly now, but Ford was very anxious about the sort of people he could see assembling on the ground beneath them. Friendly, local wocket-hunting types were dispersing, and thick, heavy, bull-necked, slug-like creatures with rocket launchers were, it seemed, sliding out of what was usually called thin air. Thin air, as all experienced galactic travellers well know, is in fact extremely thick with multidimensional complexities. Up! Bellowed Ford again. Up, Colin! Go up! Colin was straining and groaning. They were now more or less stationary in the air. Ford felt as if his fingers were breaking. Up! They stayed put. Up! 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 A slug was preparing to launch a rocket at him. Ford couldn't believe it. He was hanging from a towel in midair, and a slug was preparing to fire rockets at him. He was running out of anything he could think of doing and was beginning to get seriously alarmed. This was the sort of predicament that he usually relied on having the guide available for to give advice, however infuriating or glib, but this was not a moment for reaching into his pocket. And the guide seemed to be no longer a friend and ally, but was now itself a source of danger. These were the guide officers he was hanging outside, for Zark's sake, in danger of his life from the people who now appeared to own the thing. What had become of all the dreams he now vaguely remembered having on the Bwynelli Atoll? They should have let it all be. They should have stayed there. Stayed on the beach, loved good women, lived on fish. He should have known it was all wrong the moment they started hanging grand pianos over the sea monster pool in the atrium. He began to feel thoroughly wasted and miserable. His fingers were on fire with clenched pain, and his ankle was hurting. Oh, thank you, ankle, he thought to himself bitterly. Thank you for bringing up your problems at this time. I expect you'd like a nice warm foot bath to make you feel better, wouldn't you? Or at least you'd like me to... He had an idea. The armoured slug had hoisted the rocket launcher up onto its shoulder. The rocket was presumably designed to hit anything in its path that moved. Ford tried not to sweat because he could feel his grip on the seams of his towel slipping. With the toe of his good foot, he nudged and prized at the heel of the shoe on his hurting foot. Go up, damn you! Ford muttered hopelessly to Colin, who was cheerily straining away, but unable to rise. Ford worked away at the heel of his shoe. He was trying to judge the timing, but there was no point. Just go for it. He only had one shot, and that was it. He had now eased the back of his shoe down off his heel. His twisted ankle felt a little better. Well, that was good, wasn't it? With his other foot, he kicked at the heel of the shoe. It slipped off his foot and fell through the air. About half a second later, a rocket erupted up from the muzzle of its launcher, encountered the shoe falling through its path, went straight for it, hit it, and exploded with a great sense of satisfaction and achievement. This happened about 15 feet from the ground. The main force of the explosion was directed downwards, where, a second earlier, there had been a squad of Infinity Enterprises executives with a rocket launcher standing on an elegant terraced plaza paved with large slabs of lustrous stone cut from the ancient alabastrum quarries of Zental Quabula that was now, instead, a bit of a pit with nasty bits in it. A great whump of hot air welled up from the explosion, throwing Ford and Colin violently up into the sky. Ford fought desperately and blindly to hold on, and failed. He turned helplessly upwards through the sky, reached the peak of a parabola, paused, and then started to fall again. He fell and fell and fell, and suddenly winded himself badly on Colin, who was still rising. He clasped himself desperately onto the small spherical robot. Colin slewed wildly through the air towards the tower of the guide offices, trying delightedly to control himself and slow down. The world span sickeningly round Ford's head as they span and twisted round each other, and then, equally sickeningly, everything suddenly stopped. Ford found himself deposited dizzily on a window ledge. His towel fell past, and he grabbed at it and caught it. Colin bobbed in the air inches away from him. Ford looked around himself in a bruised, bleeding, and breathless state. The ledge was only about a foot wide, and he was perched precariously on it, 13 stories up. 13. He knew they were 13 stories up because the windows were dark. He was bitterly upset. He had bought those shoes for some absurd price in a store on the Lower East Side in New York. He had, as a result, written an entire essay on the joys of great footwear, all of which had been jettisoned in the mostly harmless debacle. Damn everything. And now one of the shoes was gone. He threw his head back and stared at the sky. It wouldn't be such a grim tragedy if the planet in question hadn't been demolished, which meant that he wouldn't even be able to get another pair. Yes, given the infinite sideways extension of probability, there was, of course, an almost infinite multiplicity of planets Earth, but when you came down to it, a major pair of shoes wasn't something you could just replace by mucking about in multidimensional space-time. He sighed. Oh well, he'd better make the best of it. At least it saved his life, for the time being. He was perched on a foot-wide ledge, 13 stories up the side of a building, and he wasn't at all sure that was worth a good shoe. He stared in woozily through the darkened glass. It was as dark and silent as the tomb. No, that was a ridiculous thing to think. He'd been to some great parties in tombs. Could he detect some movement? He wasn't quite sure. It seemed that he could see some kind of weird flapping shadow. Perhaps it was just blood dribbling over his eyelashes. He wiped it away. Boy, he'd love to have a farm somewhere, keep some sheep. He peered into the window again, trying to make out what the shape was. But he had the feeling, so common in today's universe, that he was looking into some kind of optical illusion, and that his eyes were just playing silly buggers with him. Was there a bird of some kind in there? Was that what they had hidden away up here in a concealed floor behind darkened, rocket-proof glass? Someone's aviary? There was certainly something flapping about in there, but it seemed like not so much a bird, more a sort of bird-shaped hole in space. He closed his eyes, which he'd been wanting to do for a bit anyway. He wondered what the hell to do next. Jump? Climb? He didn't think there was going to be any way of breaking in. Okay, the supposedly rocket-proof glass hadn't stood up, when it came to it, to an actual rocket, but then that had been a rocket that had been fired at very short range from inside, which probably wasn't what the engineers who designed it had had in mind. It didn't mean he was going to be able to break the window here by wrapping his fist in his towel and punching. What the hell, he tried anyway, and hurt his fist. It was just as well he couldn't get a good swing from where he was sitting, or he might have hurt it quite badly. The building had been sturdily reinforced when it was completely rebuilt after the Frogstar attack, and was probably the most heavily armoured publishing company in the business. But there was always, he thought, some weakness in any system designed by a corporate committee. He had already found one of them. The engineers who designed the windows had not been expecting them to be hit by a rocket from short range from the inside, so the window had failed. So, what would the engineers not be expecting someone sitting on the ledge outside the window to do? He racked his brains for a moment or so before he got it. The thing they wouldn't be expecting him to do was to be there in the first place. Only an absolute idiot would be sitting where he was, so he was winning already. A common mistake that people make when trying to design something completely foolproof was to underestimate the ingenuity of complete fools. He pulled his newly acquired credit card from his pocket, slid it into the crack where the window met the surrounding frame, and did something a rocket would not have been able to do. He wiggled it around a bit. He felt a catch slip. He slid the window open, and almost fell backwards off the ledge, laughing, giving thanks as he did so for the great ventilation and telephone riots of SRDT 3454. The great ventilation and telephone riots of SRDT 3454 had started off as just a lot of hot air. Hot air was, of course, the problem that ventilation was supposed to solve, and generally it had solved the problem reasonably well, up to the point that someone had invented air conditioning, which solved the problem far more throbbingly. And that was all well and good, provided you could stand the noise and the dribbling, until someone else came up with something even sexier and smarter than air conditioning, which was called in-building climate control. Now this was quite something. The major differences from just ordinary air conditioning were that it was thrillingly more expensive, involved a huge amount of sophisticated measuring and regulating equipment, which was far better at knowing moment by moment what kind of air people wanted to breathe than mere people did. It also meant that to be sure that mere people didn't muck up the sophisticated calculations which the system was making on their behalf, all the windows in the buildings were built, sealed, shut. This is true. While the systems were being installed, a number of the people who were going to work in the buildings found themselves having conversations with BreathoSmart systems fitters, which went something like this. But what if we want to have the windows open? You won't want to have the windows open with new BreathoSmart.
Yes, but suppose we just wanted to have them open, you know, for a little bit.
You won't want to have them open even for a little bit. The new BreathoSmart system will see to that. Enjoy BreathoSmart.
Okay, so what if the BreathoSmart breaks down or goes wrong or something?
Aha! One of the smartest features of the BreathoSmart is that it cannot possibly go wrong. So, no worries on that score. Enjoy your breathing now and have a nice day.
It was, of course, as a result of the great ventilation and telephone riots of SRDT 3454 that all mechanical or electrical or quantum mechanical or hydraulic or even wind, steam or piston-driven devices are now required to have a certain legend emblazoned on them somewhere. It doesn't matter how small the object is, the designers of the object have got to find a way of squeezing the legend in somewhere because it is their attention which is being drawn to it rather than necessarily that of the users. The legend is this. The major difference between a thing that might go wrong and a thing that cannot possibly go wrong is that when a thing that cannot possibly go wrong goes wrong, it usually turns out to be impossible to get at or repair. Major heat waves started to coincide with almost magical precision with major failures of the BreathoSmart systems. To begin with, this merely caused simmering resentment and only a few deaths by asphyxiation. The real horror erupted on the day that three events happened simultaneously. The first event was that BreathoSmart Inc. issued a statement to the effect that best results were achieved by using their systems in temperate climates. The second event was the breakdown of a BreathoSmart system on a particularly hot and humid day, with the resulting evacuation of many hundreds of office staff into the street, where they met the third event, which was a rampaging mob of long-distance telephone operators who had got so twisted with having to say all day and every day, "Thank you for using BSNS," to every single idiot who picked up a phone that they had finally taken to the streets with trash cans, megaphones and rifles. In the ensuing days of carnage, every single window in the city, rocket-proof or not, was smashed, usually to accompanying cries of, "Get off the line, arsehole! I don't care what number you want, what extension you're calling from, go and stick a firework up your bottom! Yee-haw! Hoo-hoo-hoo! Valoom! Squawk!" and a variety of other animal noises that they didn't get a chance to practice in the normal line of their work. As a result of this, all telephone operators were granted a constitutional right to say, "Use BSNS and die," at least once an hour when answering the phone, and all office buildings were required to have windows that opened, even if only a little bit. Another unexpected result was a dramatic lowering of the suicide rate. All sorts of stressed and rising executives who had been forced during the dark days of the BreathoSmart tyranny to jump in front of trains or stab themselves could now just clamber out onto their own window ledges and leap off at their leisure. What frequently happened, though, was that in the moment or two they had to look around and gather their thoughts, they would suddenly discover that all they really needed was a breath of air and a fresh perspective on things, and maybe also a farm on which they could keep a few sheep. Another completely unlooked-for result was that Ford Prefect, stranded 13 stories up a heavily armoured building armed with nothing but a towel and a credit card, was nevertheless able to clamber through a supposedly rocket-proof window to safety. He closed the window neatly after him, having first allowed Colin to follow him through, and then started to look around for this bird thing. The thing he realised about the windows was this. Because they had been converted into openable windows after they had first been designed to be impregnable, they were in fact much less secure than if they had been designed as openable windows in the first place. "Hey-ho, it's a funny old life," he was just thinking to himself, when he suddenly realised that the room he'd gone to all this trouble to break into was not a very interesting one. He stopped in surprise. Where was the strange flapping shape? Where was there anything that was worth all this palaver, the extraordinary veil of secrecy that seemed to lie over this room, and the equally extraordinary sequence of events that had seemed to conspire to get him into it? The room, like every other room in this building now, was done out in some appallingly tasteful grey. There were a few charts and drawings on the wall. Most of them were meaningless to Ford. But then he came across something that was obviously a mock-up for a poster of some kind. There was a kind of bird-like logo on it, and a slogan which said, "The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy Mark II, the single most astounding thing of any kind ever. Coming soon to a dimension near you." No more information than that. Ford looked around again. Then his attention was gradually drawn to Colin, the absurdly overhappy security robot, who was cowering in a corner of the room, gibbering with what seemed strangely like fear. Odd, thought Ford. He looked around to see what it was that Colin might have been reacting to. Then he saw something that he hadn't noticed before, lying quietly on top of a workbench. It was circular and black and about the size of a small side plate. Its top and its bottom were smoothly convex, so that it resembled a small, lightweight throwing discus. Its surfaces seemed to be completely smooth, unbroken and featureless. It was doing nothing. Then Ford noticed there was something written on it. Strange. There hadn't been anything written on it a moment ago, and now suddenly there was. There just didn't seem to have been any observable transition between the two states. All it said, in small, alarming letters, was a single word. Panic. A moment ago there hadn't been any marks or cracks on its surface. Now there were. They were growing. Panic, the guide Mark II said. Ford began to do as he was told. He had just remembered why the slug-like creatures looked familiar. Their colour scheme was a kind of corporate grey, but in all other respects, they looked exactly like Bogons. Chapter 13. The ship dropped quietly to land on the edge of the wide clearing, 100 yards or so from the village. It arrived suddenly and unexpectedly, but with a minimum of fuss. One moment it was a perfectly ordinary late afternoon in the early autumn. The leaves were just beginning to turn red and gold. The river was beginning to swell again with the rains from the mountains in the north. The plumage of the picker birds was beginning to thicken in anticipation of the coming winter frosts. Any day now the perfectly normal beasts would start their thunderous migration across the plains, and old Thrashbarg was beginning to mutter to himself as he hobbled his way around the village, a muttering which meant that he was rehearsing and elaborating the stories that he would tell of the past year once the evenings had drawn in and people had no choice but to gather round the fire and listen to him and grumble and say that wasn't how they remembered it. And the next moment there was a spaceship sitting there, gleaming in the warm autumn sun. It hummed for a bit and then stopped. It wasn't a big spaceship. If the villagers had been experts on spaceships, they would have known at once that it was a pretty nifty one. A small, sleek, rundy four-berth runabout with just about every optional extra in the brochure except advanced vectoid stabilisys, which only wimps went for. You can't get a good, tight, sharp curve around a trilateral time axis with advanced vectoid stabilisys. All right, it's a bit safer, but it makes the handling go all soggy. The villagers didn't know all that, of course. Most of them here on the remote planet of Lamuella had never even seen a spaceship, certainly not one that was all in one piece. And as it shone warmly in the evening light, it was just the most extraordinary thing they'd come across since the day Kerp caught a fish with a head at both ends. Everybody had fallen silent. Whereas a moment before, 2 or 3 dozen people had been wandering about, chattering, chopping wood, carrying water, teasing the picker birds, or just amiably trying to stay out of old Thrashbarg's way, suddenly all activity died away, and everybody turned to look at the strange object in amazement. Or not quite everybody. The picker birds tended to be amazed by completely different things. A perfectly ordinary leaf lying unexpectedly on a stone would cause them to skitter off in paroxysms of confusion. Sunrise always took them completely by surprise every morning. But the arrival of an alien craft from another world simply failed to engage any part of their attention. They continued to car and rit and huck as they pecked for seeds on the ground. The river continued its quiet, spacious burbling. Also, the noise of loud and tuneless singing from the last hut on the left continued unabated. Suddenly, with a slight click and a hum, a door folded itself outwards and downwards from the spaceship. Then, for a minute or two, nothing further seemed to happen, other than the loud singing from the last hut on the left, and the thing just sat there. Some of the villagers, particularly the boys, began to edge forward a little bit to have a closer look. Old Thrashbarg tried to shoo them back. This was exactly the sort of thing that old Thrashbarg didn't like to have happening. He hadn't foretold it, not even slightly, and even though he'd be able to wrestle the whole thing into his continuing story somehow or other, it really was all getting a bit much to deal with. He strode forward, pushed the boys back, and raised his arms and his ancient knobbly staff into the air. The long, warm light of the evening sun caught him nicely. He prepared to welcome whatever gods these were, as if he'd been expecting them all along. Still, nothing happened. Gradually it became clear that there was some kind of argument going on inside the craft. Time went by, and old Thrashbarg's arms were beginning to ache. Suddenly, the ramp folded itself back up again. That made it easy for Thrashbarg. They were demons, and he had repulsed them. The reason he hadn't foretold it was that prudence and modesty forbade. Almost immediately, a different ramp folded itself out on the other side of the craft from where Thrashbarg was standing, and two figures at last emerged on it, still arguing with each other and ignoring everybody, even Thrashbarg, whom they wouldn't even have noticed from where they were standing. Old Thrashbarg chewed angrily on his beard. To continue to stand there with his arms upraised, to kneel with his head bowed forward and his staff held out pointing at them, to fall backwards as if overcome in some titanic inner struggle, perhaps just to go off to the woods and live in a tree for a year without speaking to anyone. He opted just to drop his arms smartly as if he had done what he had meant to do. They were really hurting, so he didn't have much choice. He made a small secret sign he had just invented towards the ramp, which had closed, and then made 3.5 steps backwards so he could get a good look at whoever these people were, and then decide what to do next. The taller one was a very good-looking woman, wearing soft and crumply clothes. Old Thrashbarg didn't know this, but they were made of Rimplon, a new synthetic fabric, which was terrific for space travel because it looked its absolute best when it was all creased and sweaty. The shorter one was a girl. She was awkward and sullen-looking, and was wearing clothes which looked their absolute worst when they were all creased and sweaty. And what was more, she almost certainly knew it. All eyes watched them, except for the picker birds, which had their own things to watch. The woman stood and looked around her. She had a purposeful air about her. There was obviously something in particular she wanted, but she didn't know exactly where to find it. She glanced from face to face among the villagers assembled curiously around her, without apparently seeing what she was looking for. Thrashbarg had no idea how to play this at all, and decided to resort to chanting. He threw back his head and began to wail, but was instantly interrupted by a fresh outbreak of song from the hut of the sandwich maker, the last one on the left. The woman looked round sharply, and gradually a smile came over her face. Without so much as a glance at old Thrashbarg, she started to walk towards the hut. There is an art to the business of making sandwiches, which it is given to few ever to find the time to explore in depth. It is a simple task, but the opportunities for satisfaction are many and profound, choosing the right bread, for instance. The sandwich maker had spent many months in daily consultation and experiment with Grapp the baker, and eventually they had, between them, created a loaf of exactly the consistency that was dense enough to slice thinly and neatly, while still being light, moist, and having the best of that fine nutty flavour which best enhanced the savour of roast, perfectly normal beast flesh. There was also the geometry of the slice to be refined, the precise relationships between the width and height of the slice, and also its thickness, which would give the proper sense of bulk and weight to the finished sandwich. Here again, lightness was a virtue, but so too were firmness, generosity, and that promise of succulence and savour that is the hallmark of a truly intense sandwich experience. The proper tools, of course, were crucial, and many were the days that the sandwich maker, when not engaged with the baker at his oven, would spend with Strinder the toolmaker, weighing and balancing knives, taking them to the forge and back again. Suppleness, strength, keenness of edge, length and balance were all enthusiastically debated, theories put forward, tested, refined, and many was the evening when the sandwich maker and the toolmaker could be seen silhouetted against the light of the setting sun and the toolmaker's forge, making slow sweeping movements through the air, trying one knife after another, comparing the weight of this with the balance of another, the suppleness of a third, and the handle binding of a fourth. Three knives altogether were required. First, there was the knife for the slicing of the bread, a firm, authoritative blade which imposed a clear and defining will on a loaf. Then there was the butter-spreading knife, which was a whippy little number, but still with a firm backbone to it. Early versions had been a little too whippy, but now the combination of flexibility with a core of strength was exactly right to achieve the maximum smoothness and grace of spread. The chief amongst the knives, of course, was the carving knife. This was the knife that would not merely impose its will on the medium through which it moved, as did the bread knife. It must work with it, be guided by the grain of the meat, to achieve slices of the most exquisite consistency and translucency, that would slide away in filmy folds from the main hunk of meat. The sandwich maker would then flip each sheet, with a smooth flick of the wrist, onto the beautifully proportioned lower bread slice, trim it with four deft strokes, and then at last perform the magic that the children of the village so long to gather round and watch with rapt attention and wonder. With just four more dexterous flips of the knife, he would assemble the trimmings into a perfectly fitting jigsaw of pieces on top of the primary slice. For every sandwich, the size and shape of the trimmings were different, but the sandwich maker would always effortlessly and without hesitation assemble them into a pattern which fitted perfectly. A second layer of meat and a second layer of trimmings, and the main act of creation would now be accomplished. The sandwich maker would pass what he had made to his assistant, who would then add a few slices of newcomer and fladdish and a touch of splagberry sauce, and then apply the topmost layer of bread and cut the sandwich with a fourth and altogether plainer knife. It is not that these were not also skilful operations, but they were lesser skills to be performed by a dedicated apprentice, who would, one day, when the sandwich maker finally laid down his tools, take over from him. It was an exalted position, and that apprentice, Drimple, was the envy of his fellows. There were those in the village who were happy chopping wood, those who were content carrying water, but to be the sandwich maker was very heaven. And so the sandwich maker sang as he worked. He was using the last of the year's salted meat. It was a little past its best now, but still the rich savour of perfectly normal beast meat was something unsurpassed in any of the sandwich maker's previous experience. Next week it was anticipated that the perfectly normal beasts would appear again for their regular migration, whereupon the whole village would once again be plunged into frenetic action, hunting the beasts, killing perhaps six, maybe even seven dozen of the thousands that thundered past. Then the beast must be rapidly butchered and cleaned, most of the meat salted, to keep it through the winter months until the return migration in the spring, which would replenish their supplies. The very best of the meat would be roasted straight away for the feast that marked the autumn passage. The celebrations would last for 3 days of sheer exuberance, dancing, and stories that old Thrashbarg would tell of how the hunt had gone, stories that he would have been busy sitting making up in his hut while the rest of the village was out doing the actual hunting. And then the very, very best of the meat would be saved from the feast and delivered cold to the sandwich maker. And the sandwich maker would exercise on it the skills that he had brought to them from the gods, and make the exquisite sandwiches of the third season, of which the whole village would partake before beginning the next day to prepare themselves for the rigours of the coming winter. Today he was just making ordinary sandwiches, if such delicacies so lovingly crafted could ever be called ordinary. Today his assistant was away, so the sandwich maker was applying his own garnish, which he was happy to do. He was happy with just about everything, in fact. He sliced, he sang, he flipped each slice of meat neatly onto a slice of bread, trimmed it, and assembled all the trimmings into their jigsaw. A little salad, a little sauce, another slice of bread, another sandwich, and another verse of Yellow Submarine. "Hello, Arthur." The sandwich maker almost sliced his thumb off. The villagers had watched in consternation as the woman had marched boldly to the hut of the sandwich maker. The sandwich maker had been sent to them by Almighty Bob in a burning, fiery chariot. This, at least, was what Thrashbarg said, and Thrashbarg was the authority on these things. So, at least, Thrashbarg claimed, and Thrashbarg was, and so on, and so on. It was hardly worth arguing about. A few villagers wondered why Almighty Bob would send his only begotten sandwich maker in a burning fiery chariot, rather than perhaps in one that might have landed quietly without destroying half the forest, filling it with ghosts, and also injuring the sandwich maker quite badly. Old Thrashbarg said that it was the ineffable will of Bob, and when they asked him what ineffable meant, he said, "Look it up." This was a problem, because old Thrashbarg had the only dictionary, and he wouldn't let them borrow it. They asked him why not, and he said that it was not for them to know the will of Almighty Bob. And when they asked him why not again, he said, because he said so. Anyway, somebody sneaked into old Thrashbarg's hut one day while he was out having a swim, and looked up ineffable. Ineffable apparently meant unknowable, indescribable, unutterable, not to be known or spoken about. So that cleared that up. At least they'd got the sandwiches. One day, old Thrashbarg said that Almighty Bob had decreed that he, Thrashbarg, was to have the first pick of the sandwiches. The villagers asked him when this had happened exactly, and Thrashbarg said it had happened yesterday when they weren't looking. "Have faith," old Thrashbarg said, "or burn." They let him have the first pick of the sandwiches. It seemed easiest.
And now this woman had just arrived out of nowhere and gone straight for the sandwich maker's hut. His fame had obviously spread, though it was hard to know where to, since, according to old Thrashbark, there wasn't anywhere else. Anyway, wherever it was she'd come from, presumably somewhere ineffable, she was here now and was in the sandwich maker's hut. Who was she? And who was the strange girl who was hanging around outside the hut moodily and kicking at stones and showing every sign of not wanting to be there? It seemed odd that someone should come all the way from somewhere ineffable in a chariot that was obviously a vast improvement on the burning fiery one which had brought them the sandwich maker, if she didn't even want to be here. They all looked to Thrashbarg, but he was on his knees, mumbling, and looking very firmly up into the sky, and not catching anybody else's eye until he had thought of something. "Trillion," said the sandwich maker, sucking his bleeding thumb. "What? Who? When? Where?" "Exactly the questions I was going to ask you," said Trillian, looking around Arthur's hut. It was neatly laid out with his kitchen utensils. There were some fairly basic cupboards and shelves and a basic corner in the bed. A door at the back of the room led to something that Trillian couldn't see because the door was closed. "Nice," she said, in an inquiring tone of voice. She couldn't quite make out what the setup was. "Very nice," said Arthur. "Wonderfully nice. I don't know when I've ever been anywhere nicer. I'm happy here. They like me, I make sandwiches for them, and... well, that's it, really. They like me, and I make sandwiches for them."
Sounds idyllic,
said Arthur firmly. "It is, it really is. I don't expect you'd like it very much, but for me it's... well, it's perfect. Look, sit down, please, make yourself comfortable. Can I get you anything? a sandwich?
Trillian picked up a sandwich and looked at it. She sniffed it carefully.
"Try it," said Arthur. "It's good."
Trillian took a nibble, then a bite, and munched on it thoughtfully.
"It is good," she said, looking at it.
"My life's work," said Arthur, trying to sound proud and hoping he didn't sound like a complete idiot. He was used to being revered a bit and was having to go through some unexpected mental gear changes.
"What's the meat in it?" asked Trillian.
"Ah, yes, that's perfectly normal beast."
"It's what?"
"Perfectly normal beast. It's a bit like a cow, or rather a bull. Kind of like a buffalo, in fact, large, charging sort of animal."
"So what's odd about it?"
"Nothing. It's perfectly normal."
"I see," said Trillian.
"It's just a bit odd where it comes from," said Arthur.
Trisha frowned and stopped chewing. "Where does it come from?" she said, with her mouth full. She wasn't going to swallow until she knew.
"Well, it's not just a matter of where it comes from, it's also where it goes to. It's all right, it's perfectly safe to swallow. I've eaten tons of it. It's great. Very succulent, very tender. Slightly sweet flavour with a long, dark finish."
Trillian still hadn't swallowed. "Where," she said, "does it come from, and where does it go to?"
"They come from a point just slightly to the east of the Hondo Mountains. They're the big ones behind us here. You must have seen them as you came in. And then they sweep in their thousands across the great Anhondo Plains, and, well, that's it, really. That's where they come from. That's where they go."
Trillian frowned. There was something she wasn't quite getting about this.
I probably haven't made it quite clear," said Arthur. "When I say they come from a point to the east of the Hondo Mountains, I mean that's where they suddenly appear. Then they sweep across the Anhondo Plains and, well, vanish, really. We have about 6 days to catch as many of them as we can before they disappear. In the spring they do it again, only the other way round, you see."
Reluctantly, Trillian swallowed. It was either that or spit it out, and it did in fact taste pretty good.
"I see," she said, once she had reassured herself that she didn't seem to be suffering any ill effects.
"And why are they called perfectly normal beasts?"
"Well, I think because otherwise people might think it was a bit odd. I think old Thrashbarg called them that. He says that they come from where they come from, and they go to where they go to, and that it's Bob's will, and that's all there is to it."
"Who? Just don't even ask."
"Well, you look well on it," said Trillian.
"I feel well. You look well."
"I'm well. I'm very well."
"Well, that's good," said Arthur.
"Yes.
Good.
Good.
Nice of you to drop in."
"Thanks."
Said Arthur, casting around himself, astounding how hard it was to think of anything to say to someone after all this time.
"I expect you're wondering how I found you," said Trillian.
Yes, said Arthur. "I was wondering exactly that. How did you find me?"
"Well, as you may or may not know, I now work for one of the big sub-ether broadcasting networks that..."
"I did know that," said Arthur, suddenly remembering.
Yes, you've done very well. That's terrific. Very exciting. Well done. Must be a lot of fun.
That's exhausting. All that rushing around, I expect it must be, yes.
We have access, said Trillian, to virtually every kind of information. I found your name on the passenger list of the ship that crashed.
Arthur was astonished. You mean they knew about the crash?
Well, of course they knew, said Trillian.
You don't have a whole space liner disappear without someone knowing about it.
But you mean they knew where it had happened? They knew I'd survived?
Yes.
But nobody's ever been to look or search or rescue. There's been absolutely nothing.
Well, there wouldn't be, said Trillian. It's a whole complicated insurance thing. They just bury the whole thing, pretend it never happened. The insurance business is completely screwy now. You know they've reintroduced the death penalty for insurance company directors.
Really, said Arthur?
No, I didn't. For what offence?
Trillian frowned.
What do you mean, offence?
I see.
Trillian gave Arthur a long look, and then, in a new tone of voice, said, It's time for you to take responsibility, Arthur.
Arthur tried to understand this remark. He found it often took a moment or so before he saw exactly what it was that people were driving at, so he let a moment or two pass at a leisurely rate. Life was so pleasant and relaxed these days, there was time to let things sink in. He let it sink in. He still didn't quite understand what she meant, though, so in the end he had to say so.
Trillian gave him a cool smile, and then turned back to the door of the hut. Random, she called, come in. Come and meet your father.
Chapter 14. As the guide folded itself back into a smooth, dark disk, Ford realized some pretty hectic stuff. Or at least he tried to realize it, but it was too hectic to take in all in one go. His head was hammering, his ankle was hurting, and though he didn't like to be a wimp about his ankle, he always found that intense, multidimensional logic was something he understood best in the bath. He needed time to think about this. Time, a tall drink, and some kind of rich, foamy oil. He had to get out of here. He had to get the guide out of here. He didn't think they'd make it together. He glanced wildly round the room. Think, think, think. It had to be something simple and obvious. If he was right in his nasty, lurking suspicion that he was dealing with nasty, lurking Vogons, then the more simple and obvious, the better. Suddenly, he saw what he needed. He wouldn't try to beat the system, he would just use it. The frightening thing about the Vogons was their absolute mindless determination to do whatever mindless thing it was they were determined to do. There was never any point in trying to appeal to their reason, because they didn't have one. However, if you kept your nerve, you could sometimes exploit their blinkered, bludgeoning insistence on being bludgeoning and blinkered. It wasn't merely that their left hand didn't always know what their right hand was doing, so to speak. Quite often, their right hand had a pretty hazy notion as well. Did he dare just post the thing to himself? Did he dare just put it in the system and let the Vogons work out how to get the thing to him, while at the same time they were busy, as they presumably would be, tearing the building apart to find out where he'd hidden it? Yes. Feverishly he packed it. He wrapped it. He labelled it. With a moment's pause to wonder if he really was doing the right thing, he committed the package to the building's internal mail chute. Colin, he said, turning to the little hovering ball, I'm going to abandon you to your fate.
I'm so happy, said Colin.
Make the most of it, said Ford, because what I want you to do is nursemaid that package out of the building. They will probably incinerate you when they find you, and I won't be here to help. It'll be very, very nasty for you, and that's just too bad. Got it?
I gurgle with pleasure, said Colin.
Go, said Ford. Colin obediently dived down the mail chute in pursuit of his charge. Now Ford had only himself to worry about, but that was still quite a substantial worry. There were noises of heavy running footsteps outside the door, which he had taken the precaution of locking and shifting a large filing cabinet in front of. He was worried that everything had gone so smoothly. Everything had fitted terribly well. He'd hurtled through the day with reckless abandon, and yet everything had worked out with uncanny neatness. No, except for his shoe. He was bitter about his shoe. That was an account that was going to have to be settled. With a deafening roar, the door exploded inwards. In the turmoil of smoke and dust, he could see large slug-like creatures hurrying through. So everything was going well, was it? Everything was working out as if the most extraordinary luck was on his side. Well, he'd see about that. In a spirit of scientific inquiry, he hurled himself out of the window again.
Chapter 15.
The first month, getting to know each other, was a little difficult. The second month, trying to come to terms with what they'd got to know about each other in the first month, was much easier. The third month, when the box arrived, was very tricky indeed. At the beginning, it was a problem even trying to explain what a month was. This had been a pleasantly simple matter for Arthur here on La Muella. The days were just a little over 25 hours long, which basically meant an extra hour in bed every single day, and of course having regularly to reset his watch, which Arthur rather enjoyed doing. He also felt at home with the number of suns and moons which La Muella had, one of each, as opposed to some of the planets he'd fetched up on from time to time, which had had ridiculous numbers of them. The planet orbited its single sun every 300 days, which was a good number because it meant the year didn't drag by. The moon orbited La Muella just over 9 times a year, which meant that a month was a little over 30 days, which was absolutely perfect because it gave you a little more time to get things done in. It was not merely reassuringly like Earth, it was actually rather an improvement. Random, on the other hand, thought she was trapped in a recurring nightmare. She would have crying fits and think the moon was out to get her. Every night it was there, and then, when it went, the sun came out and followed her, over and over again. Trillian had warned Arthur that Random might have some difficulty in adjusting to a more regular lifestyle than she'd been used to up till now, but Arthur hadn't been ready for actual howling at the moon. He hadn't been ready for any of this, of course. His daughter? His daughter? He and Trillian had never even... had they? He was absolutely convinced he would have remembered. What about Zaphod? Not the same species, Arthur, Trillian had answered. When I decided I wanted a child, they ran all sorts of genetic tests on me and could find only one match anywhere. It was only later that it dawned on me. I double-checked and I was right. They don't usually like to tell you, but I insisted. You mean you went to a DNA bank? Arthur had asked, pop-eyed. Yes, but she wasn't quite as random as her name suggests, because, of course, you were the only Homo sapiens donor. I must say, though, it seems you are quite a frequent flyer. Arthur had stared wide-eyed at the unhappy-looking girl who was slouching awkwardly in the doorframe looking at him. But when? How long... You mean what age is she? Said Trillian. Yes, the wrong one. What do you mean? I mean, said Trillian, that I haven't any idea. What? Well, in my timeline, I think it's about 10 years since I had her, but she's obviously quite a lot older than that. I spend my life going backwards and forwards in time, you see, with the job. I used to take her with me when I could, but it just wasn't always possible. Then I used to put her into daycare time zones, but you just can't get reliable time tracking now. You leave them there in the morning and you've simply no idea how old they'll be in the evening. You complain till you're blue in the face, but it doesn't get you anywhere. I left her at one of the places for a few hours once, and when I came back, she'd passed puberty. I've done all I can, Arthur. It's over to you. I've got a war to cover. The 10 seconds that passed after Trillian left were about the longest of Arthur Dent's life. Time, we know, is relative. You can travel light years through the stars and back, and if you do it at the speed of light, then when you return, you may have aged mere seconds, while your twin brother or sister will have aged 20, 30, 40, or however many years it is, depending on how far you travelled. This will come to you as a profound personal shock, particularly if you didn't know you had a twin brother or sister. The seconds that you have been absent for will not have been sufficient time to prepare you for the shock of new and strangely distended family relationships when you return. 10 seconds silence was not enough for Arthur to reassemble his whole view of himself and his life in a way that suddenly included an entire new daughter, of whose merest existence he had not had the slightest inkling of a suspicion when he'd woken that morning. Deep emotional family ties cannot be constructed in 10 seconds, however far and fast you travel away from them. And Arthur could only feel hopeless, bewildered, and numb as he looked at the girl standing in his doorway, staring at his floor. He supposed there was no point in pretending not to be hopeless. He walked over and he hugged her. I don't love you, he said. I'm sorry, I don't even know you yet, but give me a few minutes. An extract from Practical Parenting in a Fractally Demented Universe. We live in strange times. We also live in strange places, each in a universe of our own. The people with whom we populate our universes are the shadows of whole other universes intersecting with our own.
being able to glance out into this bewildering complexity of infinite recursion and say things like, "Oh, hi, Ed. Nice tan. How's Carol?" involves a great deal of filtering skill for which all conscious entities have eventually to develop a capacity in order to protect themselves from the contemplation of the chaos through which they seethe and tumble. So, give your kid a break, okay? What's this? Arthur had almost given up. That is to say, he was not going to give up. He was absolutely not going to give up. Not now, not ever. But if he had been the sort of person who was going to give up, this was probably the time he would have done it. Not content with being surly, bad-tempered, wanting to go and play in the Paleozoic era, not seeing why they had to have the gravity on the whole time, and shouting at the sun to stop following her, Random had also used his carving knife to dig up stones to throw at the picker birds for looking at her like that. Arthur didn't even know if Lamuella had a Paleozoic era. According to old Thrashbarg, the planet had been found fully formed in the navel of a giant earwig at 4:31 Runday afternoon, and although Arthur, as a seasoned galactic traveller with good O-level passes in physics and geography, had fairly serious doubts about this, it was rather a waste of time trying to argue with old Thrashbarg, and there had never been much point before. He sighed as he sat nursing the chipped and bent knife. He was going to love her if it killed him, or her, or both. It wasn't easy being a father. He knew that no one had ever said it was going to be easy, but that wasn't the point, because he'd never asked about being one in the first place. He was doing his best. Every moment he could rest away from making sandwiches, he was spending with her, talking to her, walking with her, sitting on the hill with her, watching the sun go down over the valley in which the village nestled, trying to find out about her life, trying to explain to her about his. It was a tricky business. The common ground between them, apart from the fact that they had almost identical genes, was about the size of a pebble, or rather, it was about the size of Trillion, and of her they had slightly differing views.
End of side 3.